Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. We're talking about baseball, and I'm talking about baseball with one of my best friends. Chris Arvidsson is a writer, among many other things, including a wonderful political consultant, is a writer. She's also a Detroit Tigers fan, and she loves the American game of baseball. And with a friend of hers, has edited a new volume called The Love of Baseball, Essays by Lifelong Fans. Chris, first of all, tell us about, we've talked about recently, we've talked a little bit about whether or not athletes really can accept female commentators on their games. How is it that so many women love baseball so much? And in your case, why do you love it so much?
Well, that's a great question, because if you look at the stands, there's a lot of women out there. If you look at my book, there's a lot of women in this book. I think it's, and I've been asked this question before, and in trying to answer it was how I started thinking about writing this book. And I'm going to let one of the writers in this book answer it for me. It's Nancy Gutierrez, who happens to be the
dean at UNC
of the
Charlotte.
College of Liberal Arts and Sciences at UNC Charlotte, and a Shakespeare scholar who is also a huge baseball fan. And she is a Cleveland Indians freak. She writes, "The writer John Gardner once compared the experience of reading to a vivid and continuous dream. So, too, is the experience of a baseball game. But not a dream in the sense of something just at the edge of our consciousness, romantic and chaotic, but rather a dream that moves inexorably and inevitably as each step leads to a next step, to a denouement that has its own logic and lucidity. The experience of immersing oneself in a baseball game is to inhabit a world parallel to our own, proceeding apace with its own rationale and inevitability. In other words, it is a story."
So this is a scholar of literature who says a baseball game is a story. Is like a story. Well, you've got different reasons. I know you're just.
Well,
I
agree with her, and when I answered my friend who asked me that, who was also a scholar, I did come to the conclusion that it was like a story, not nearly so elegantly as Nancy, but it has a beginning, a middle, and an end. No matter what, the season has a pace. I have something very intriguing about that, I think. And the places in between the action are places where you're really in the game. And I don't think that's true of other more action-oriented sports. I think women are attracted more to baseball, too.
And you think, is it because of the pauses in the action that it goes slowly?
Yeah, I think that's – I'm not one of those people that thinks the game is too long. I don't think that. I don't have a problem with the length of games.
Well, you're introducing something new to me in terms of what it is about stories that hold us together, and when we're reading them or when we're hearing them read or when people are sitting around the campfire reading them, one of the things that is attractive to me, at least, is that you don't know what's going to happen next, or you don't think you do. And so in baseball, at every moment when the batter is at bat, you don't, and the pitcher is warming up, you don't know whether the pitch is going to be a good enough pitch to hit. If it is good enough, you don't know whether the batter is going to be able to connect with it. If he does connect with it, you don't know whether it's going to be a pop-up or whether it's going to go out of the park or whether it's going to go to the shortstop. And then if it goes to the shortstop, whether he's going to bobble it or he's going to make a perfect throw you at every moment you don't know what the next step is going to be.
That's right.
Even though there's no action going on, you're contemplating. Here I am. You've
exactly.
turned me on to. This is supposed to be your answer.
To figure that out, you have the time to sort of get that all in your head before it actually happens. And you know, it is really true. Just like Yogi said, it ain't over till it's over.
Well, that's right. You could be behind 10 to nothing going into the ninth inning, and you could catch up. It's not likely, but it could always happen. You can't really go
that's
home.
That's right.
You can't go home again. Well, what is the, I guess, changing the subject, but in my idea, getting back to the original subject, what is the source of your passion for the Detroit Tigers? Why would you pick a team like the Detroit Tigers to fall in love with?
Well, that's where I grew up, and I think most of the people in the book, and certainly most of the people I know who are fans, have, you know, developed a love of baseball when they were young, either playing it or wanting to play it, in the case of many of the women who write in this book, or they listened to it or watched it on TV with their family, usually a parent.
Well, I want you to talk about you and Detroit. I mean,
yeah.
Is it particular players or was it?
When I was a kid, I was listening to one of the great baseball radio commentators of all time, Ernie Harwell. So, I was in the primo baseball town. The Tigers won in '68 with legendary players like Mickey Lolich and Al Kaline and Willie Horton, and there's just not, that's no better. There's no better team that ever was for a kid to want to listen to and pay attention to.
We hear stories of little boys whose dads, the bonding between a father and a son over mm-hmm. the baseball team. Is that the way it is with little girls too?
It is.
With absolutely. Their dad or their not with their mom?
Well, with my dad in my case, although it certainly is true about moms too, because there are definitely moms who are baseball freaks who, you know, I had a lot of people tell me stories about, you know, coming home from school and their mom was sitting at the kitchen table smoking a cigarette listening to the baseball game. You know, it's very, very much a parent-kid thing, I think, to start with.
I don't want to belabor this too much, but I'm still curious about it from the standpoint of a woman. I mean, is it sexist to say that women can't play Major League Baseball or can't play professional baseball?
Well, yet, I don't know. I think we'll see.
Well, I'm just saying that I the point of my thinking about it is that here are women so deeply in love with a particular game, and they can't aspire to play it like a little boy can. And
no, that's true. That's true. And it's, you know, it's a source of angst for a lot of little girls. Although I think that's changing, and I think that we'll see a time when that, you know, that might not be the case. Somebody's good enough; they're going to play.
Yeah. Well, that would. Well, that's a good answer to it, and. So part of it is you're just not worried about the fact that you could never play, but there is a – I'm putting words in your mouth, so correct me if I'm wrong. You're saying it's not a sin to hope that someday we'll figure out a way for women and men to compete in this great sport together. All right. I'm visiting with my friend Chris Arvidsson. We're talking about baseball, and really we're talking about the fans of baseball. Chris Arvidsson is the editor and an author of an essay in a collection of essays called The Love of Baseball, Essays by Lifelong Fans. She and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. We're talking about baseball. I'm talking about it with one of my great friends, Chris Arvidsson, who has edited, along with a colleague, a book of essays by lifelong fan is called We Love or The Love of Baseball. Chris, we've talked a little bit about your love of baseball. Tell us about one of the interesting stories is your co-editor, Diana Nelson Jones. Who is she and how did you get to know her and what's her love of baseball all about?
She's a freak, just like me. It's very fun. I was living in Pittsburgh, and so was going to a lot of Pirates games, and Diana writes for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, where she has written for as a reporter and columnist for more than 25 years. At the time I first got to Pittsburgh, she was writing sports, and she wrote a column about my then favorite player for the Pirates, a guy named Jason Kendall, who was the catcher. And I sent her a fan mail email telling her how much I liked this column. And we actually got to know each other and started hanging out and going to games together. So we were baseball buddies while I lived in Pittsburgh. We always stayed in touch. And when I first started thinking about this book, I thought, well, duh, that's the perfect person to do this book with. Well, she, like I said, is a freak.
Well, tell her to prove it. Tell us about her essay and while you're doing that, talk about the Roberto Clemente fan club.
Yeah, Roberto Clemente. She grew up loving Roberto Clemente. She lived in West Virginia, and so was a Pirates fan because that was the close major league team that they followed. She started a Roberto Clemente fan club when she was a kid that you belonged to by sending stamps. That was your fee, and then you would get this newsletter.
You'd send a stamp, and then she'd send you a newsletter as long as your share of the stamps held up.
Yeah, and she's like eight when she's doing this. So this is her first writing assignments, right? It's no wonder that she ended up being a newspaper writer. And she this one little bit that she has in her essays, when I first read it, it just made the hair on the back of my neck stand up.
Because
it's if you're a big fan of a team or a particular player, it just goes right to it. I'll read you this little bit.
All right.
My dad procured tickets for the game on August 18, 1968. The night before, Mother granted me an old bed sheet, and I got out my permanent markers and a Spanish dictionary to look up the words for happy birthday and began making a sign to hold up the next day. From our perch in right field, I unfurled the sign, which read, Feliz cumpleaños, Roberto. He was stretching his neck, and I was bouncing the sign when his teammate nudged his arm and pointed up at me. Roberto looked up. He smiled and took off his cap and waved it at me. And I think my father had to hold the top of my shorts to keep me from flying off the upper tier. I mean, isn't that fantastic?
Well, there's that's beautiful, and it's made more poignant by the tragedy of that followed.
Yes, that befell him. Yeah.
Remind us about that.
The Pirates are and the Roberto Clemente Foundation in Pittsburgh are actively raising money and stuff for Puerto Rico right now. Because it was in a relief effort for Puerto Rico that Roberto was killed in a plane crash.
A long time, some time ago. And,
yeah.
But the memories about him, at least with respect to your co-editor, Diana Nelson Jones, he lives strong in her memory, at least.
Oh, man, yeah. Yeah. I think, that's... following him and starting that fan club started a couple things for her. It started her career as a writer, her lifelong fanhood of baseball. And also, interestingly enough, it started her quest to learn Spanish. And later on, she goes and interviews Roberto's widow as a Pittsburgh Post reporter.
Yeah. Well, I love her closing where she says, I watch players who are physical marvels, masters of technique and physique, but in none is there a hint of what I saw in Roberto. I mean, this is a woman who's deeply in love with the dead guy. I mean,
oh yeah, definitely.
Chris, your book of essays written by, I would just say, a bunch of crazy fans, people who, you've introduced the word that y'all are a group of weirdos who love the game.
The
game. And you divide it into different sections, roughly, because these are all essays by different people. But you introduce the concept of the early season and the spring training. And do you have a favorite story, either in your book or a favorite story you have about these other crazy people who make a, you know, it's like a pilgrimage. Every spring they go down to Florida, from this region at least, go down to Florida and have the best time in the world worshiping.
Oh, gosh.
Tell us about that. Do you do that?
I used to. I have yet to convince certain people in my household that we ought to be doing that. I think actually this book might be my ticket to spring training 2018, hopefully. I might schedule some things that would make it possible for us to go. I did used to go. It's a very different experience than a major league ballpark. It's real close. It's like going to a high school or college, small college game, really. I know it's changed some over the years where it's not quite as intimate as it might have been when I was regularly going. But I remember one time I was going to a Phillies game and they were playing the Blue Jays in Florida. And one team had their park in Dunedin and the other team had theirs just down the road in Clearwater. And we went to the game, and I used to go early, and the field was really wet and muddy. So the teams just said, this field is crap today. Let's just move. So everybody just got in their cars and went to the other field. Just drove over there.
Oh, really?
Like the team, everybody, just the hot dog people wrapped up boxes of hot dogs, and the Labatt's people put their beer in some trash cans, and they just went to the other field.
Well, what is life? Go down and do you just watch two or three games a day, or do you just hang around the rest of the time and talk baseball, or how does the pilgrimage work?
Well, you go down, and usually the hardcore, which is mostly what's there, we'll go and go early and watch batting practice. And, usually they're by 11 or so at least in the morning for a game that doesn't start until 1. And you never leave a game before it's over, of course, because that's just a rule. And you get to know people in the stands and you see them again the next day for that time period that you're there. It's fun. If you go to a Tigers game down there, it's hilarious because the parking lot is just full of Michigan license plates because of the snowbird factor, they call it, because people from the Midwest.
They're already down in Florida?
They go down to Florida in the springtime, yeah. Yep. So same thing with the Minnesota Twins or any of the Midwest teams.
Chris, this isn't fair, but in your part one section of your collection of essays by baseball fans about their favorite things about baseball in spring training, have you got a favorite? Have you got a favorite or one of your favorites of the essays that are centered around the early, either baseball or the early season?
About going to spring training?
Yeah.
Well, I think in that section, the really interesting one that is kind of unexpected is the Brendan O'Meara story, that where he's talked to a batting coach about the idea that if you hit the ball a certain way at a certain speed and you do it just right, that the seams of the baseball will burn the wood on the bat and you can smell it.
No.
Yeah. It's a great story.
It's a great story, but you don't believe it, do you?
Well, I don't know. Ted Williams believed it.
Well, what is...
Here's what happens. Here's how he describes it. It's the perfect confluence of elite power on power. A no-name taking four-seam fastball must whip in with a little bit of rise. It should scream in somewhere north of 95 miles per hour. Next, a batter with world-shaking bat speed must make contact and foul the ball straight back to the screen. It's the firmest, most aggressive contact you can make without hitting the ball to the deepest, most remote recesses of a ballpark. It's impossibly frustrating to be that close to such contact, but if struck just right, the seams burn the wood. And Ted Williams said, only the guys who can whip that lumber have smelled it.
Well.
And he says every once in a while, you know, if you can watch guys who are like into that, whether it's superstition or you know, for real, you'll see guys in batting practice every once in a while when they foul one back like that really hard, sniff the bat. So if you see somebody sniffing the bat, that's what they're doing.
Well, all right. Well, you taught me something. We're talking about baseball. I'm visiting with Chris Arvidsson. She is the editor of a new set of essays called The Love of Baseball, Essays by Lifelong Fans, and she and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Chris Arvidsson. Chris, along with Diana Nelson-Jones, is the editor of a new volume about baseball. It's called The Love of Baseball, Essays by Lifelong Fans. It is published by McFarlane and available in some bookstores, on the web, at Amazon and other places, and also directly from McFarlane. And Chris, I bet you've got a few copies in the trunk of your car, that wherever you are.
I do.
You might be.
Yeah.
Able to,
I went to my homecoming for my undergraduate at my little college in Michigan, Olivet.
Mm-hmm.
And like 25 people bought books from me.
Wow.
I know.
Fantastic.
And mostly they were gifts. It's interesting. A lot of people like to, even if they're not a baseball fan, they know somebody who is, and so they like to buy it as a gift.
No, I think that's a good pitch, that for a baseball fan to read the comments of other crazy baseball fans about why they love the game, and it legitimizes other baseball fans' passion, unreasonable passion for the game, which gets me to my next question.
Mm-hmm.
What is this thing about the Ten Commandments of a baseball fan? And this is written by your husband, Henry Doss. And did you write this for him just so he could get his name in the book?
No, I did not. Wrote it all by himself.
Tell us about this essay.
I fooled him. He knew nothing about baseball. I mean, nothing. He'd never even been to a game when he met me. So knowing that I was a big baseball fan, to say it mildly, was part of the package. It's not like, you know, optional understanding. You can either like understand what's going on and get with the program or not. And it's fun because the few places that we've been so far reading, and Henry's been along and read parts of his story, it gets a pretty big response from the audience. They really understand these commandments.
What are some of the commandments?
Well, here's the one that, you know, is fairly obscure. But last Saturday at Scuppernong, there were people there that went, oh, yeah, that's how I do it. So,
what is that?
Number nine is.
Number what now?
Number nine.
Well, give it, what is it?
Thou must eat your peanuts with the shell on.
How do you do that?
You just do it.
You put the whole shell in your mouth and crack it with your teeth and get the salt off the shell. And then are you allowed to spit the shell out before you swallow the peanuts?
No, you eat it.
No, come on. Now, you can't. That could lead to some disastrous consequences. That's a little bit too much bulk, isn't it, to load up on?
It's great.
Now, I'd never heard of that before, that that's the only way to eat peanuts, your husband says. Is he just kidding?
Absolutely.
Hello, Chris?
Yeah.
Is he just kidding?
No, I'm not kidding.
How does that work?
All right. As Henry says, you take the peanut out of the bag and you shove it in your face and you chew. That's it.
All right. One at a time, I hope. Okay. All right.
Excuse me. Yes. One at a time.
You're good. Now, are any other controversial commandments that you got there? Here's one.
Okay. It's okay to root for a team other than your favorite in postseason play.
Gotcha. That's a good commandment, and this is the 10th commandment of the baseball fans. And this is a good one because it gives you license when you're favorite team is eliminated from a competition, that you can shift to your second favorite or to another favorite and enjoy the – you don't have to completely give up on the competition. Now, Chris,
right.
there's some fans who just can't do that. They just love their team so much that when their team loses or doesn't make the playoffs or the World Series, they just go into mourning.
They do, but most of my exposure is that people have secondary teams, and they'll go to them.
What is your secondary team? You're a Detroit Tigers passionate fan.
I like the Pirates, the Pirates and the Nats and the Orioles.
So those are the places you've lived near those.
Yeah.
Near those, and it's okay to have if you move someplace and there's a team. That team can be your secondary. All right, I'm visiting with Chris Arvidsson, and she's fighting a cold while we talk, so we're going to take a quick break.
Sorry.
No, we're good, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Chris Arvidsson. She is one of the editors of a new book, The Love of Baseball, Essays by Lifelong Fans, and Chris, thanks for visiting with us, for battling through your cold, and you're my hero for doing that right now.
Thank you.
Your book is a collection of essays written by not baseball players, but baseball fans, some of whom we know. One of those fans whom many of us in Chapel Hill know is a great former poet laureate of North Carolina, Joseph Bethanty, who grew up in Pittsburgh. And tell us about his essay.
Well, Joseph writes about a famous game where a guy named Bill Mazeroski hits a tremendous home run. And there's wonderful pictures of it in any baseball book that you'll see. And Joseph is a guy who played baseball as a young man, and he loves baseball. And he loves the Pittsburgh Pirates, so I, of course, knew that he needed to have something in his book. And it was very easy for him to find something appropriate because he loves the game. We talk about it.
Yeah, well, I love the essay because he confesses that he and his father have two different versions of the same set of facts. And that it's kind of it proves that memories about important things can sometimes not be totally accurate.
And he never contradicts his father either.
Well, his father was a...
No, he never tries to correct him. He lets it go.
Well, he does not either. He puts it right out there in the essay that he and his father have different views of the... I mean, that's what makes the essay
Absolutely.
Interesting.
Absolutely. It is. And, it's a very lovely father-son story, too.
Well, he says, as the Pirates came to bat in the end of the ninth, I stood and made a proclamation in a voice ethereal enough to somehow compel the attention of all 36,000 so fans that day swelling Forbes Field. And I imagined myself enveloped in a heavenly shimmer, a sudden eerie hush falling with minions. And only a fiction writer could write this. And as they, or a poet could write this, as they turned as one to where my dad and I sat in general admission, I, a seven-year-old prophet, gave warning that Maz would hit it out of the on the second pitch, and then, by God, he did. Now, he says, I like my father's version. How do you think? I mean, this is that we do have memories, but we try to insert ourselves and our families into these as actors in some of these.
Well, right, and if they're really good like that, you know, why argue?
Why argue with a good story, whether it's true or not?
Yeah.
It's true in the sense that it's his father's love for his son and for the team. Yeah.
Yeah, family lore is family lore.
Well,
it's not history, right?
Joe Bethany confesses that his memory is that he watched that game on television, not in the stands.
Right.
That's a great thing. Now, you have a wonderful essay. I'd forgotten. It has several points to it. One is how Al Kaline lost his position as number one in your mind in terms of your favorite players. How did that happen?
He crushed me. I thought really a lot about whether or not to even include that.
Tell us the story.
Because Al Kaline is he is Mr. Tiger. That's what they call him. He's done everything. He was a youngest ever batting champion. He was a hero in the 68 World Series. He's been a broadcaster. He works with the front office still. He is as big a Detroit Tiger as there is. And one year of spring training, he was broadcasting with George Cal, another great Tiger player. And I waited outside the booth at the park to get an autograph. And he came out of that booth, and I was, like, really respectful. I called him Mr. Kaline, very politely asked him for an autograph, and he just blew me off.
What are you doing here? Did he say something to you, or did he just...
He said, what are you doing here? Get out of here. To me. And I was crushed. I was crushed, D.G.
Did you cry, or did you just...
I almost burst into tears. And George Cal was right behind him.
Who is he?
The other broadcaster, uh-huh. who was a Tiger third baseman in his playing time. I revered Tiger. He took one look at my face and was mortified at Kaline's behavior, really. And he sat down with me right there in the stands and talked to me for like 10 minutes to try to make up for what had happened.
Well, do you think that, did Kel tell you whether or not Kaline was famous for doing this? Or did this, maybe he's just mad, maybe he had a bad day at work or a bad day at home?
I don't know, maybe he just had a bad day, I have no idea. I've heard mixed things about whether or not he's the kind of guy to do that. I've never, you know, he doesn't have a reputation of being a mean guy or anything, but boy, he sure was mean to me that day. It was horrible.
And can you get over it if he came and apologized or something? Could you?
I guess I could, but I'll tell you, I've never asked for another autograph of anybody ever.
From any other player, because
no.
Well, I mean,
I don't want to have that happen again, man. I don't want it to happen again. too horrible.
Well, I think it gives. I think your story gives comfort to some of the others of us crazies who will hang around and try to get, you know, a signature from a famous player, or to help us solidify the memory. Many times the players, they've got other things on their minds. They've got their kind. They just can't stop and give autographs. Others seem to be able to and willing to accommodate thousands of times. But
right. I mean, this is Mr. Tiger. You think he'd have a minute? There was nobody else there that would have. You know, he wasn't being mobbed.
Uh huh. And if he'd said, "I'm so sorry. I just can't do it today. Maybe another time." Or if he said something nice.
Yeah, that would have been fine. Yeah.
Well,
I'm in a hurry. Sorry, I can't. Whatever.
Well, I'm, and that it's poignant when a hero shows a side of him or her that you can't, can no longer worship that hero. Or maybe it's a good thing.
That's right.
Well, there's another story, and we have to tell it pretty quickly, about how you were able to get into the World Series and see Detroit play in the World Series.
I'm sitting right here looking at my 1984 World Series pennant, my framed World Series program cover, and the three ticket stubs from the games that I was at, and my furry tiger ear headband. I still have them all. The program is fading a little bit. I probably should have it reframed, but the short story is that through my work, I got in D.C., I got access to four tickets to the three games in Detroit of the World Series in 1984. And not to the last minute, like the day before, I didn't find out I could get the tickets. And I had to get to Detroit by a certain time to get them from a guy named Howard Pastor, who was Major League Baseball's chief lobbyist in D.C. And I got them.
It's kind of a trains, airplanes story where you got to, and around the world in 80 days, you got to get there and make it in time, or those tickets are going to disappear. And your story is suspenseful, and all of us have gone through something like that. But the payoff for you.
What
was
a happy
time.
Ending, though.
Yep.
I mean.
Well, what now? Yeah. You were working in the political establishment, and this was a lobby. What did you and the people on your political side do for Major League Baseball to pay them back for getting those tickets for you?
Nothing that I know of.
Well, it is.
Those are the kinds of things that people would give to. Actually, there were a lot of people from the Michigan delegation at that game. And I don't know if Howard had bought a whole section or what. But.
Well, it was a great thing for you, Chris, and it reminds us of how important, but how crazily important, these tidbits of our experience with our favorite athletic teams, whether it's Carolina basketball, Davidson basketball, or Notre Dame football, or major league teams. We somehow or another go crazy about them, and we save those mementos as if they were precious religious relics. It's a crazy thing.
Absolutely.
And you and your colleagues in your new book, The Love of Baseball, Essays by Lifelong Fans, capture some of that craziness in a very positive way. The book, The Love of Baseball, Essays by Lifelong Fans, edited by Chris Arvidsson and Diana Nelson-Jones, is published by McFarland, the great publisher up in West Jefferson, North Carolina, which publishes a lot of great books that are important for us North Carolinians. Also available.
And a ton of baseball books, D.G.
And a ton of other best. Yeah, go to the. If you don't like this one, go to others. Go to McFarland's webpage and you'll find many others, and others for Revolutionary and Civil War history and other important things. But mainly, Chris, thanks for this book, The Love of Baseball. It has opened the doors to a new appreciation of baseball and its fans for me. Thanks.
And thanks, DG.
Thanks to Chris Arvidsson. Thanks all y'all for listening. This is DG Martin, who's talking. I'll be back here before you know it.